Your home is important. That's why GEICO helps make it easy to save on condo insurance. Because home is more than just a place. Home is where you took minimalism too far because there's only one chair in your entire condo and your only entertainment is one card. Not even a deck of cards, but a single card. And all your guests have to share one plate and one fork, but you're convinced that less stuff means more freedom. The GEICO Insurance Agency could help protect the overly minimalist broom closet you call home. Call GEICO and see how easy it is to switch and save on condo insurance.
The internet can be your window to the world, or an open door that lets cyber criminals in. Online theft, webcam spying, and identity fraud are all on the rise. But you can stay safe with Kaspersky Lab, the world's most awarded internet security. Kaspersky protects your money, privacy, identity, and data with technology perfected over 20 years. So keep exploring. Kaspersky Lab will keep you safe online. Learn more at Kaspersky.com.
The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
Can we get all that without computers?
They don't let us out much.
Who the hell eats Spam Fajitas?
You have the right to bear arms or the right to arm bearers, whatever you want to do, I don't care.
But I get sunburned when I bear my arms.
In a world where Care Bears don't care no more.
Where apathy is now gone.
You're listening to This Week in Geek on 90.1 FM, The Heat, Niagara's new rock.
It has been established that persons who have recently died have been returning to life and committing acts of murder.
Hey everyone, what's going on? This is Mike the Birdman Dodd, and well, today we are talking something that is very near and dear to my heart. That's right, we are talking about Night of the Living Dead. But I am not alone in this zombie-infested world.
No, you are not.
Exactly. I'm joined with my ever-awesome co-host, Pierce the Punk Dirkstrom, Geek Gamers, which we probably should do an episode of that sometime
soon.
Yeah,
we have one of those coming out shortly, so you guys stay tuned for that. But yeah, I would kill you if you did this interview without me.
Exactly. Yes, this interview kind of landed in our lap. I decided we were watching, actually, Diary of the Dead, which recently came out this past Tuesday, which is George Romero's latest installment in the Dead franchise.
Amazing film.
Which is more or less a restart to the franchise. And I went on his IMDb Pro page, and I contacted his agent, Chris Rowe, or his manager, sorry. And I got talking with Chris, and I found out that he did a documentary called One for the Fire, which is an all-new feature-length documentary, which is included on the 40th anniversary DVD, which also came out this past Tuesday. And right now we are speaking with Chris himself about the documentary experience, being a filmmaker, and just living in a world where the dead rise. And this is where Chris should normally say hello.
Well, hello. I was actually in shock because I'm not used to such a great introduction.
Well, I do like to make my guests feel awesome. It's what I do.
We definitely do try here.
So,
well,
yeah.
Good.
So, yes, Chris, we picked up your DVD, and just before we went to air, we were just recently telling you, we went to Best Buy over in Amherst in New York State. And
just
we
across
ran
the border.
And we ran into somebody who is buying this DVD specifically for your documentary, who's one of our new friends. His name's Ken, so hopefully he's listening. And, we didn't even know this was coming out, which I feel like a very bad fan for saying that. But,
I don't think that you have to feel like a bad fan. To be kind of honest with you, it really kind of came in under the radar very quickly, because as soon as the Weinstein Company announced that they were going to release Diary of the Dead in May, they immediately had been wanting to do Night of the Living Dead, and I think they might have been thinking about releasing it, you know, a few weeks, you know, 3 or 4 weeks later after Diary, but then they decided last minute not to, and to release both the same day, which I think was a good idea.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, It's a great sort of package, because when Kim was there buying, that we saw he had Diary of the Dead, Night of the Living Dead. It was just, and I mean, for us, we came home and we actually did watch both of them back to back. We just sort of had a dead day. It's sort of a great experience, but we definitely love the new DVD, and especially the documentary that you co-directed, One for the Fire. Tell us about this documentary. How did you sort of get the idea to make this, and what was the process that you went through?
Well, you know, I honestly had been talking to George for quite some time about doing a documentary, and you know, we had been kicking the idea back and forth for several years, But about, oh, I'd say summer of 2006, I said, you know, if we really don't start getting to work on this soon, we're going to lose the opportunity. And just as business would have it, things got crazy. We started to lose track of time. Diary of the Dead got picked up, and that went into production, and that is exactly what happened. We just lost track of time. And it was probably, I'm guessing, April of 2007 when all of a sudden I went, oh, my God, it's the 40th anniversary next year. And what caused me to really realize that was I had gotten a call from a film festival wanting to kind of pay tribute to that for the 40th. And I went, oh, my God, now's the time to do this. And I immediately thought of people that I wanted to work with on this. I knew George was really too busy, and he just couldn't spend the time doing it because he was wrapped up with Diary. And I talked to a friend of mine by the name of Rob Lucas, who's a great cameraman, and that's kind of how it really happened. I had spoken to Rob months earlier about the idea of it, but we really didn't get together on it until probably 8 months later. And what had happened was we had an opportunity to where four of the cast members were all going to be together at the same time. And we said, well, look, this is the perfect opportunity. Save ourselves some trips. Let's go down. Let's take a camera. Let's shoot this. And that's what we did. So we actually started photography on this, principal photography, in June of 2007.
Now, sorry, Chris, go ahead.
No, please, go ahead.
I was about to say, now, when you got part of the original cast together, what, like have these people been in contact for years? Basically, what was it like being in the room with people that were part of such an iconic horror movie?
Well, fortunately, again, I knew them all. So it was relatively easy to put it just bluntly. It was easy. I knew Russ Striner and John Russo and Bill Hinesman and Judy O'Day and George Cassana. I didn't know. George, who plays the sheriff in the movie, was really the one person that I had never met. But most of the people who were attached to the movie, I have met before. So it was easy. You pick up the phone, you say, hey, it's Chris Rowe, George Romero's manager. And of course, people usually pick up the phone for you very quickly. Everyone was very anxious and eager and felt like it was long overdue. Russ Striner and John Russo both had said that they were thinking about doing kind of a definitive 40th anniversary type documentary as well, or at least they wanted to. So it was easy. And being able to sit down with them and talk and reminisce was beautiful. But I have to say, and maybe I'm jumping ahead of myself here, but I have to say probably the most memorable occasion of the entire shoot was actually going back to the cemetery, going to the location where the home was, going down to the basement where Karen Cooper, played by Kyra Schoen, was kind of lived for the shoot. It was really amazing because in some ways things had never changed. You have the Evans City Cemetery that really looks the same, with the exception of a tornado had gone through there, I think, 10 or 15 years ago, and it just ripped up a lot of trees and damaged some tombstones. But for the most part, the tombstones are all the same, with the exception of some of the new dates stamped on them. In that area of the cemetery where the original movie was shot, everything is pretty much still there. The original farmhouse is gone, but all the land around it is there. Even the trees that you see in the movie, they're still standing. And then, of course, to go down into the basement, which was shot in a completely separate location in downtown Pittsburgh, a little trivia there for people who didn't realize that, it was shot in the offices of the Leighton Image. And it was shot in the basement. And you walk down into the basement, and it looks identical to the basement 40 years ago, with the exception of, I think, an electrical box, a couple electrical boxes, and some new ventilation pipes. It's just the exact same basement. So it was emotional. You know, people had a wonderful time with it. Judy O'Day hadn't been back to that cemetery in 40 years. And what we discovered was that they were shooting in that cemetery in August of 2000, in August of 1967. We were shooting there in August of 2007, 40 years ago to the date.
Man, yeah, definitely, you know, watch.
They were running around that cemetery and the farmhouse almost 40 years ago to the date. So it was really kind of a trip down memory lane for those guys, and it was great.
Yeah, when we were watching, even though we definitely, of course, were not part of the experience, we still, we could feel that sort of magic, that sort of sentimental and quality of it. It was very surreal to see those actors in that same spot and just go back to the locations at present day. That was one of the things that I loved about the documentary. But back to One for the Fire, what was one of the main things that you wanted to accomplish with this documentary?
Well, I think one of the things that I wanted to accomplish was for everyone to see the various actors, get to know them a little better, learn a little bit more about the movie, learn kind of how it all got started. And I think in a way you do that. I think you really hear the story of Night of the Living Dead from the mouths of those people who made the movie. You hear some wonderful stories about George Romero. You find a different side of George that most people really don't know or didn't know existed. But he's an incredibly funny man. He's an incredibly emotional man. And you hear of the games and the practical jokes and the fun things that they used to do, and you get a good chuckle out of it, I think. And I think fans will enjoy that. And I think that's what we tried to accomplish, was to bring you closer to that group of people. We were very fortunate enough to interview Carl Hardman just a few months before he passed away.
Mm-hmm.
In what was his very last interview. And I think Carl Hardman gives one of the most emotional and most beautiful moments of the entire documentary when he talks about Duane Jones.
Definitely. Actually, that's something I actually wanted to follow up on. What was it like being in the room with Carl as he talked about Duane, just seeing the emotion in his face? I mean, there's something about that. It kind of touched me, and I could almost feel something coming. It was like a tear, but I'm not sure what it was, but it's definitely an emotional experience there. And I'm just wondering, what was it like to be in the room while this was happening?
Well, actually, it was very emotional, because I think for those of us who were in the room and saw it happening, I was sitting 3 feet from him, and Rob, who was operating the camera, was 4 feet from him, and Kyra was there, and you know, everyone just kind of beat it up with tears. I don't recall that I actually let the tears flow, but I felt that tingly sensation that you get. And I felt the urge to want to, you know, move forward with the next step, which would be to let the tears flow, but it didn't happen. Carl was very visibly upset, and we just moved right on to the very next question. But it was an experience that I don't think any of us in the room will forget, and it was a beautiful tribute to Duane Jones.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the things I also wanted to talk to you about. Of course, with documentaries, you're going out and capturing things just as they happen, quite unlike a feature-length film where you know what you're going to be getting that day. You sort of have some idea with documentary, but what's it like for you to go out and be shooting these things and not know what you're going to have at the end of the day?
Well, that was the fun part of it, because, you know, if you do something that's too scripted, especially something telling the story of an iconic film such as Night of the Living Dead,
mm-hmm.
it loses what you're trying to do. Here you hear the story of Night of the Living Dead from the people who made it, and yet each story, although how similar they are, because they're all so similar, each one is a little different. And you, the viewer, even though you were not present to hear each of the stories, I, of course, heard them all, and I can tell you that it was very interesting to hear each story. Each story was a little different. Each story had a few extra little tidbits added in, and that's the fun thing about documentary filmmaking, is that you don't know what you're going to hear. You know, in some cases, we heard stories that completely contradicted other people who were right there. And so, you know, in order to kind of sit down and edit everything together and make sure it comes off okay, it wasn't really too difficult, because for the most part, things stuck to the same, you know, outline. However, there were a few things that varied, and I think it was great, to be honest with you. I'm glad, because it allows you to see that it's not really a scripted movie, but it's just directly from the mouths of the people who made it, and it's their opinions.
Mm-hmm. What was one of the most fulfilling parts for you personally while working on this documentary?
Probably one of the most fulfilling parts for me was getting people together who hadn't been together in a long, long time. Night of Living Dead has been 40 years of turmoil and controversy, and there's been internal bickering and fighting amongst the cast members, and I mean, it's just been an ongoing issue. And to really see people who have held on to hard feelings or had issues with one another for a long time, to see people get together and reunite and pay tribute to themselves and to their colleagues for a movie that was made 40 years ago for peanuts, that ended up going out to become a movie that redefined the genre and became one of the most successful independent films ever made, was a beautiful thing to witness. And to see people get along, and to see these people tell their stories and yet be very complimentary of one another, when at times through the years they haven't always been. So that was the, I think, real rewarding thing. And of course now we're out on this 40th anniversary reunion tour, mm-hmm. where we're doing 7 cities domestically and 6 cities internationally. George and the entire original cast of the movie, and that's been a very beautiful experience.
Definitely sounds like it. Is there anything else that you wish you could have accomplished with the documentary? Because I know there has been so much controversy about Night of Living Dead, especially with the 30th anniversary edition of it, all the remakes and re-releases.
And then there was the one that was done in 3D, and then the unofficial sequels and whatnot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, some of those we try to forget.
Yeah.
I think because of time constraints, we didn't actually end up making the documentary we really wanted to make. And again, I think holding up the tradition of Night of the Living Dead, there ended up being turmoil between myself and my partner. And then that carried right on over to the editing room, where we had problems with the editor. So it was like right up to the very end there were problems. So I don't think that we released, at least this is my opinion, I don't think that I got to release what I really wanted to. I think there were certainly a handful of other people that I really wanted to have involved in it, and I believe that there were some people that didn't make it into it that really should have been. Mm-hmm. Again, it was really that I had nothing to do with it. It really all kind of fell into the lap of the editor, and it was up to the editor to get these things in. We were under such time constraints that I didn't even get to see a rough cut of it before it went to the Weinstein Company. Company got to see it before I ever got to see it. And that is not the way a filmmaker likes his work to mm-hmm. be handled. And so that was difficult. So I believe there's still some things that really needs to still be looked at and discussed. And I haven't put the camera down, even though I'm no longer working on the project with my partner on this project. Even though we're no longer working together, I have continued to hire camera crews and to conduct interviews and to kind of follow the group around on various 40th anniversary tour stops. And I would say be on the lookout for something even better to come out, you know, maybe in a year, maybe in two. Because I don't think that the story of Night of the Living Dead is completely done. There's still, I think, some more to be said. And I think everyone kind of involved with it, even those attached to this, the other actors, they even kind of felt so as well. We're very pleased with it. There's certainly nothing like it of its kind that exists. Mm-hmm. But I think fans will be very pleased just to have something that they've never ever had before. And that's why I think the reviews on it have been so good. People are enjoying it. The critics are enjoying it. And, you know, what more can you ask for? For me, as a first-time filmmaker, I mean, I've produced some other smaller documentaries mm-hmm. and so forth, but I really look at this as like my first child, so to speak. The others were kind of stepkids. but this was kind of the first, and I mean, it's bittersweet for me, mm-hmm. but I am ultimately pleased that it has been received so well by folks like yourself and by other members of the media, and I hope that the fans enjoy it too, and I think they will, because again, nothing exists that they can even compare it to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. That's one thing I noticed while watching it, was the fact that you could tell that the documentary was made sort of amongst a family setting, how it was like you could tell that you knew these people when you were interviewing them, the friendliness that you had with George in interviews. It felt very open in that regard.
It felt extremely real.
Yeah, it felt like you were sitting there sort of in the room with them experiencing these conversations. And back to what you said before about you sort of being a first-time filmmaker, I actually want to talk to you about that. You've done produced sort of documentaries based upon other horror films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
Monster Squad,
Creepshow, all those. So what is one of the differences you find between producing these things and actually sort of getting behind the camera and directing them and writing them?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you're a producer, there's a lot of different levels of producing. Mm-hmm. And for me, on some of those, it was just about throwing the money out on the table for the project to get done. For this project was kind of a labor of love. It was something that I was very close to. Obviously, I'm very close to George. George Romero is, I consider George to be one of my very dearest friends. I care for him greatly, and I want to do it to do a good job by him for this project, and the other cast members as well. I've become very friendly with all of them, and think very highly of all of them. And so it was very important for me to do the very best job possible, and so with doing that and having those thoughts in my mind, your job, my job in this whole process was I think a little more daunting. It was stressful at times, because I think we are always most critical of our own work.
Mm-hmm.
And
definitely,
you know, for me at times, what we were shooting and the things that we were doing just wasn't good enough. I kept feeling that we had to do better, we had to do more. And you know, that's kind of how that process went. But it was a beautiful experience, and I did enjoy it. I would be a liar if I said that I didn't. As stressful as it was at times, right up to the very end, meaning as of like last week, trying to get everything done, trying to get contracts done, trying to get everything done with it, because literally things got wrapped up with this right up until the release date. Actually,
man,
we're still dealing with stuff. I mean, the contracts are still...
Technology Truths, brought to you by GEICO.
Technology Truths.
Truth. Teenagers can communicate entirely in emojis.
How was the birthday party?
pizza slice, kitten, soccer ball, pineapple?
Truth. It's so easy to switch and save on car insurance at geico.com.
What are you talking about? Paperclip, shoulder shrug, high five, wizard hat? What?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more.
You shouldn't go to Barnes & Noble and buy 10,000 books just so you can build a book fortress and yell out, "I am your book leader." You shouldn't buy 147 copies of War and Peace, stuff them inside turkeys, and serve them at Thanksgiving as turbookins. And you definitely shouldn't buy up all the copies of Dork Diaries, causing the neighborhood kids to stage a protest in your front yard. But you could. Because at the Barnes & Noble Book Haul, you can get over 1,000 titles for 50% off. Stock up at your local Barnes & Noble. Turbookins are fictitious and should not be cooked at home.
Not fully done.
Oh, almost, wow.
Almost. But it was such a rush to get this out that it was a very interesting experience. So it's been fun to say the least, and stressful. And those people who know me and who are close to me, they know just how crazy of a ride it's been and how much I really have cared about this project.
Speaking of projects, I'm looking at your IMDb page right now. What is this project you're involved with called the Collaboration?
The Collaboration is a beautiful psychological thriller, very Hitchcock in style. It was written
nice.
By a writer named Jeff Monahan, who lives right outside of Pittsburgh. Jeff actually has been in several of George Romero's movies, smaller parts, but he's a beautiful writer. And it's this great psychological thriller, and I read it about a year ago, and I fell in love with it. I just said, wow, this is a great movie. And it, you know, you experience this roller coaster ride of thrills with it. And I sent it over to one of my clients, Malcolm McDowell.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Malcolm, I've got this particular part. You might like this." And he goes, "Well, I'll take a look at it and I'll let you know." And he calls me while I'm on a business trip in Illinois, and I'm driving down Interstate 80. And I get this phone call. "Hi, love, it's Malcolm. How are you?" And I said, "I'm great, Malcolm. How are you?" "Oh, my God, love, I just read the script. It's just, oh, my God, it's great. I didn't even see it coming." And Malcolm fell in love with it and immediately jumped on board and said that he really wanted to play the character of Thornton.
That's awesome.
Who he is just perfect for. I mean, he is right for that part. And so we're right in the middle of trying to get financing wrapped up for that project. And I just optioned a project yesterday.
Wow.
Another psychological thriller called Lullaby.
Nice.
Which again, it's one of these scripts that just, you know, it has this unbelievably intense story to it. And I optioned that with a client of mine, an actress by the name of Eileen Dietz, who people will know from The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
And she's done some other really good things. And so we're going to start working on that. And the other project that I optioned earlier this year as well is a project with actress Dee Wallace, who is another client of mine. And Dee, of course, was the star of Cujo and E.T. and The Howling and a lot of great movies. And it's more of a sci-fi type movie, but an absolutely beautiful movie. The story was written by a man who is autistic.
Wow.
And so, I have three film projects that I'm working on for this year.
Nice.
So I've got plenty to keep me busy.
Yeah, sounds like it. That's one thing you're talking about, the scripts, they sound like amazing stories. And going back to sort of the Hitchcockian sort of psychological thriller, how do you feel about the current state of horror where Sony films seem to be focusing in on just the pure violence and gore to sort of to push the so-called story forward instead of like the more sort of
storyline?
Yeah, story and drama driven films, sort of like Romero's work and some of these other films that you have worked on and been a part of.
Well, torture porn has really never interested me. And I find it interesting that it's taking on such a
such a fresh life of its own. You know, move over smut films. We now have torture porn that the studios will produce. I find a lot of the films today, it's really crap. I mean, it's not sought out scripts. They're just, you know, screwy stories thrown together. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it, guys. Most of the stuff that's made today, there's no original scripts that's really being made. There's nothing out there that's fresh. It's all remake after remake after remake. I went into a meeting 4 months ago with a series of producers, and they brought me in because of who I was and some of the clients I represented, and they were very eager to get me to work with them. And they said, look, you know, we got about $35, $40 million. We're going to invest in about six projects. And so that had my attention. I mean, those are good budgets for mm-hmm. films. That's about $6 million, $7 million per picture. And I was interested until they said that they wanted all of the projects to be remakes.
Oh, that's so weak.
I looked and I said, what? But, you know, hold on. I don't think I have any ear wax in my ears. Let me clean it out. Hold on. And I said, are you serious? And they said, yeah. I mean, it's got a built-in audience already. It's low risk. I got up and excused myself from the meeting and left everyone sitting there. I said, oh, okay, well, good luck. I'm not particularly interested. And I got up and left.
Man,
the current state of not only horror but films in general. Everyone's wanting to remake movies, and we've got great writers. There are great writers all over this country with beautiful original scripts, great stories that need turned into scripts, and yet we can't get those made.
Definitely,
but we can remake movies like Psycho.
I know.
Not the Living Dead, Amityville Horror, The Wicker Man. I mean, that's in itself is a sin. I mean, first of all, I think that may go down in history as like maybe the worst possible performance Nicolas Cage has ever given.
He punched a girl in a bear costume. That was easily the best part of that movie.
I mean, but you know what I thought was funny with that movie was he, like, power kicks her and, like, flies 8 feet through the room and smashes into, like, a wall with pictures. And you go, wow. You know, at some point, he had to be shooting that movie going, what the fuck am I doing? You know, and if that didn't occur to him, the people who he has around him should have, you know, excuse me, Nick, but you know, we got to have a talk. This is career suicide. I mean, really? I mean, that I
oh, man.
Not say anymore. I mean, what an awful movie, and yet it got made.
I know, it surprises.
And again, you take someone that's got a great story, because The Wicker Man really wasn't. It wasn't. If you remember the original movie, The Wicker mm-hmm. Man was really kind of. I don't know whether you'd call it horror, but it was very kind of like a psychological thriller, I think. Mm-hmm. But it was a bizarre psychological thriller, and you know, in this. You know, it turns into a lot worse than that, and it was sad. And I keep going on about The Wicker Man because I think it's maybe one of the worst remakes I've ever seen. Amityville Horror was pretty bad. The Fog, oh my God!
Yeah, The Fog was pretty stupid.
I mean, that was bad. Adrienne Barbeau is one of my clients, and she, you know, she called me when it was announced that it was going to be remade. She called me and she told me, and I was like, oh my God, you can't be serious. And I have all these clients who are involved with these iconic horror films like Dee Wallace, The Hills Have Eyes was mm-hmm. made. I heard they're talking about remaking The Howling, Children yep. of the Corn. George Romero's Day of the Dead was just remade. Yep. I mean, I haven't seen it.
We saw that in the DVD rack, and we just sort of passed and just shuddered and just... It was a very sad moment.
Well, you know,
it's bad.
If just the idea of remaking that movie wasn't a crock of shit, seeing the cover art for it.
Yeah. Oh, man. I'm afraid to go on IMDb now just because of the fact that the shit that's being announced that's being remade, like the Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Highlander's being remade
now. All these old school sort of like horror films are being remade, like the original Evil Dead with rumors of Ashton Kutcher playing Ash. It's just these things that are enough to make you
want to vomit
and like repeatedly beat yourself against a wall. It is so sad.
Exactly.
It is so sad to see the current state of Hollywood where they are just focusing on nothing but sequels and remakes and remakes and more sequels of remakes. And it's just, it's so depressing because the fact there are so many amazing screenwriters and writers out there and just books and novels that are just waiting, being begged to be made into a movie and original stories that people need to hear. And they're just focusing on releasing the same sack of shit over and over and making it worse and worse every single time. It is so depressing.
You are exactly correct. I have a long list. I have a stack of scripts in my office that are, I probably have 20 scripts in my office that are unbelievably good scripts, solid stories, very character-driven, and 6-7 of them we've been trying to get financing for years, and we can't get financing.
Oh, man.
But yet some of the same production companies that passed on those exact scripts, they went on to make some of the worst sequels that have ever been, that's ever been made.
Wow, yeah, I got a feeling. I have a feeling that Scooby-Doo 2, Monster Island, is on that list. But
You never know.
But how does it make you feel? I mean, of course, in the documentary, we learned through all the trouble that Romero and his crew had getting just a distributor for Night of the Living Dead. How does it make you feel to see that a film as that had such social and significant impact on our society had such a hard time finding a distributor and eventually, of course, led to them getting screwed over? But how does it make you feel that had such a hard time getting released and films like Hostel got...
And Prom Night.
Yeah, Green Light got such a go-ahead budget and mainstream-wide distribution. Like, you can go in Walmart and pick up an edition of Hostel. I mean, how does that make you feel that Hollywood has changed so much where things that are considered so taboo are now... that they're so taboo that they're considered, this must be blockbuster gold.
Well, it certainly was a different time period. I mean, Night of the Living Dead came out at literally the very perfect time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a script that no one had ever seen a script like that before. First of all, I mean, you had a black man who was the hero of the movie. He smacks a white woman. That's not cool in the mid-60s. I mean, the very day that they wrapped up the movie, they threw it in the trunk of the car and was driving to New York, Martin Luther King was killed. I mean, that movie came out at a real pivotal time. The studios wanted to change the ending of the movie. Columbia, all these studios that looked at it, they wanted to change the ending. And George and everyone said, no, screw off. You can't change the ending. If you change the ending of the movie, this movie can't be Night of the Living Dead. It just won't work. And so times have changed. I mean, obviously. I mean, realistically, it was easier to get distribution on a movie back then than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot easier. I mean, take a look at the real bad, campy films that were made back then. They got distribution somehow. I mean, now you can hardly get distribution. I see films going to film festivals all the time that you just sit back and go, wow, someone's going to pick that up. Never gets picked up. And then I go into Blockbuster and I see a video sitting on the shelf for rent called The Evil Bong.
Wow, it's kind of funny. We actually know the director of that.
You go, what the hell is that? How did that get made? How come that can get made and get distribution?
I know who killed me and anyone.
I mean, God, exactly. I mean, it's like, this is insane. So it's very, you know, it's bizarre. It really is. I mean, there are some real bad low-life distributors out there that just, you know, will distribute anything. But it's very difficult to get a film made. And then, like you said, a movie like Hostel comes along, and it's torture porn at its best, and, you know, people just thrive on it. Saw. Mm-hmm.
See, I think at least the first two Saws had good storytelling, but then it degenerated into, well, stuff that even will even keep me up at night.
No, you're right. I mean, I actually didn't think that the first two Saws were bad at all. The second one I didn't care for as much. Actually, the first one and the third one I really liked. After that, forget about it. It just kind of, I think the whole franchise went south, and I hope that they are not planning on making any more, because it's just not cool.
Oh, man. So with the current state of Hollywood and filmmaking as it is, I mean, with it being so hard for actual good stuff to get out there, do you have any advice for anyone who's sort of wanting to get into the film business and, like, these people that have all these great stories and ideas? Do you have any advice for these sort of young and aspiring filmmakers about what to do in this current state of Hollywood and art in general?
Well, I think, you know, never give up, certainly. I mean, if you throw in the towel, forget about it. I mean, George Romero's quote that he always says is, look, just pick up a camera and start shooting. No matter what.
Definitely.
Doesn't make any difference. Just start shooting. Write. Start shooting. Never give up on it, because you never know. I mean, you really don't. And I think if you keep that, I mean, look at the overwhelming amount of people who are somehow able to, whether it's through stealing grandma's Social Security money and investing it in cameras or whatever.
Don't give me ideas.
They get films made. And I think it's amazing. I was just talking to some producers right before you called me from Vermont, and they're wanting to hire one of my clients, Courtney Gaines, for their movie. And, of course, for those familiar with the genre, Courtney was the star of Children of the Corn. And he played Malachi. And these guys were young filmmakers, but they have been doing everything they possibly can in order to scrape a budget together to shoot a movie. They have spent years buying equipment, years buying things that they need, becoming friendly with people within their community. So when the time came for them to make this, they could get that kind of support. And they got it. And they're shooting this movie. It's a SAG, low-budget approved project. Mm-hmm. All I can say is good for them. I mean, you know, it's not easy. But when it finally happens, it happens. Who knows how it's going to turn out? We hope it'll turn out good. It's a lovely story. But it's one of those situations where they never gave up. And they've been working and determined for years to see this happen. And it's finally happening. They start shooting, I think it's June 4th was the startup date that they wanted Courtney to fly to Vermont to start shooting this.
Wow.
That's awesome.
So never give up. Keep trying. Keep writing. Keep yourself. I think the most important thing is to keep yourself active. And if you're a writer and you're writing a script, don't write one script and think you're going to go out and get it sold. Those are total and complete miracles. You got to have your hand. You got to be like an octopus, have eight hands, and have eight different projects going all at the same time, because you'll be lucky if one of those eight projects actually gets made. Mm-hmm. You just never give up that drive, because you never know when that one project that you have is going to do it. You just never know.
And that,
I mean, you know, look at people like Clint Eastwood. You know, people think, oh, it's Clint Eastwood, he can get anything made. Wrong. I mean, whether you like the movie Unforgiven or not, I happen to think it wasn't that great of a movie, but you take a look at that movie, it took him, I think, 17 years to get it made?
Mm-hmm. Holy.
And finally, when he got it made, it won Picture of the Year, Best Director. Take a look at the movie The Apostle that Robert Duvall made. He shot that for, what, 7 years, 8 years? Not a studio in town would do it. He finally paid for it out of his own money, which is risky in this business. I mean, that's the number one rule. James Doohan, who played Scotty in Star Trek, we were having dinner one day, and he said, number one rule, Chris, never use your own money. Always use someone else. And I never forgot that. He said it to me 15 years ago. Robert used his own money. Look what happened with that. Nominated for, what, 2 Academy Awards, Best Actor, Best Actress for Farrah Fawcett, I think. He got all this critical acclaim. And he took a big gamble, dumping $5.5 million of his own money into it, but it paid off. Then you look at someone like Anthony Hopkins, who just dumped $7.5 or $8 million of his own money into this movie. I can't think of the name of it that came out this past year.
Oh, I know the one you're
and
talking
it
about.
Tanked.
Yeah.
It tanked completely. And, you know, Anthony's sitting there with a sore ass now because he's like, oh my God, I didn't enjoy that at all. $7.5 million and the movie tanked completely.
Oh man.
Not only did it tank, but the reviews, sometimes the movie will tank, but yet it'll still get good reviews.
Mm-hmm.
And people didn't even give this movie good reviews.
That's a punch in the head.
So you never know. You know, you have this brilliant filmmaker or actor, and he goes one day, oh, I'm going to be a filmmaker. If all these other people can do it, I can do it. He goes out, he tries it, and he absolutely failed at it. Mm-hmm. And I like Anthony. He's a brilliant actor, but you know, I don't know. So my advice is never give up. Keep trying. If you're a filmmaker, you pick up the camera and you just shoot as much as you possibly can. If you're a writer, write. Never stop writing.
Definitely.
You got an idea, no matter how crazy it sounds, write it down. Even if it's just an idea, go back to it later.
Well, there we go. That has been some very definitely good and sound advice from one of the coolest people I've talked to on Twig.
I know that was awesome advice. Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, Chris, for that. So we are just going to wrap this up, Chris. However, we do want to talk to you for a couple minutes off air. So we want to thank you for your time tonight. This has been a remarkable interview. And I've actually learned a lot about the industry of Hollywood now.
Same here.
So I now have a deeper appreciation.
I thank you for having me on. I hope that the fans go out and buy the DVD. Just to let you know, I won't make one penny off of it, so I'm not pushing it for that. We'll have to sell tens of thousands upon thousands of units for me to see a nickel off of it. Aww. So I'm saying to go out and get it because I think you're really going to enjoy it. And, you know, would love to hear your comments on it. You know, go to send me an email. Send it to Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at C-R-M. GT.net. Send me your comments. I'd love to know what you think. If you love it, if you hate it, if you cried, or if you got angry. I still would like to hear the comments, and thanks for your support and buying it. I just don't want to hear of riots at Best Buy.
That I can't promise.
Okay. Well, you know, I'll add that in the next documentary.
Nice.
That's going to just about do it for me and Pierce. This has been a great interview and insight into Hollywood.
Thank you so much, Chris.
It's been awesome.
Thank you.
So for This Week in Geek, we have been
Pierce Dirks.
And I'm, of course, Mike the Birdman Dodd, signing off for This Week in Geek, saying live free or die hard. Stay tuned to thisweekingeek.net for more content.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Want to see me make bubbles with my spit?
Sure do. In fact, that's the theme of our next show. So don't miss it.
Capitalism! Freaking capitalism!
Where's our cut?
The Birdman has lost his mind. Stay tuned next week when he evidently doesn't find it again.
See, the moose are extinct. We shot the last one. That's all urban legend.
Stay tuned next week for Electric Boogaloo, coming up next.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek,
Tune in next week when you hear Mike say,
and don't forget to spay or neuter your pet, noob.
So make sure to tune in next week on 90.1 FM, The Heat, Niagara's new rock. Check out our website at thisweekingeek.net for more geek content, as well as subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment about this week's episode, head to our forums at thisweekingeek.net/forums. We'll see you next week, and remember,
lower your shields and surrender your listenership.
Let's say you just bought a house. Bad news is, you're one step closer to becoming your parents. You'll proudly mow the lawn, ask if anybody noticed you mowed the lawn, tell people to stay off the lawn, compare it to your neighbor's lawn, and complain about having to mow the lawn again. Good news is, it's easy to bundle home and auto through Progressive and save on your car insurance, which, of course, will go right into the lawn. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discount not available in all states or situations.
The Starlight Lounge presents An Evening with the Progressive Box.
Old moon, yeah.
That's Hugo, tickling the ivories. He just saved by bundling home and auto with Progressive. Gonna finally buy a ring for that gal of yours, Hugo? Send her my condolences. Hi-oh! This next one's for you, too. There's a burglar in my heart. Thank you.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Discounts not available in all states or situations.